All right, I'm Christian O'Brien. Welcome back to the channel. I'm with Jason Elliott, and we're going to be replying to comments in response to the previous video, Alexandria Rethink This. And the first comment comes from Glasses No, who writes, "Yes, but good luck trying to sell my fiscal conservatism and my constitution to the white working classes. If the right can't come up with a populist message, then people like Horseface will win after Trump is done." How do you respond to this observation that we have to adopt her sort of strain of thought?
Well, Trump's strain of thought, right, the populist message. Well, the first thing that I would say to it is that the infrastructure of the Republican Party is severely underestimated as a resource for getting votes and for gaining control of things like Congress. Trump is not going to be around forever. And Trump is also extremely dangerous because he's been damaging that infrastructure. So definitely Trump as a character was, I think, hugely beneficial in winning the key states that he needed to beat Hillary Clinton and become president. But in the long term, there still needs to be a Republican Party with ideas that are consistent and which make sense and which attract very smart people to work in that infrastructure on the state level, electing representatives and senators.
And so you don't think that mirroring Alexandria Cortez is going to be a successful strategy?
Not in the long term. It can work for brief periods of time, like right now when politics are as heated as they are. It makes sense that the parties are polarizing and that they are using rhetoric which is designed to make people angry and to make people get out there and vote. But it's also alienating a lot of independents, moderates, people in the center. And I don't think it's a sustainable strategy to alienate those people from politics in the long term. They have to go to some side. And sooner or later, I think you're going to see the Democrats or the Republicans or both. They're going to recognize, at least on the sub-national level or in terms of, you know, Senate and House of Representative races, they're going to recognize that they can't just always go as far right or as far left as possible.
And the thing about it is, though, in some ways, the Republican Party strayed from the right, especially with regard to trade, however you would place that on the right-left spectrum. But as I'm sure you've seen, a lot of, you know, blue states in the Rust Belt have been flipped red pretty consistently now.
Yeah.
And some of that, I'm assuming this commenter is thinking, is attributable to Trump's populism, which is, you know, gaining traction on both the left and right. What's a good way for Republicans to retain that grip on blue, like on industrial states?
Here's what I would say is there's a distinction between the populist crassness and the ideas of protectionism, the ideas of putting America first. And I think that actually what appealed to voters was not necessarily the rudeness and the utter destruction that Trump was representing, but the ideas behind it. And while I'm not a protectionist and I don't particularly think those ideas are a good long-term strategy economically, I am very concerned about the corresponding strategy of very toxic rhetoric, which was used to promote these protectionist agendas.
Okay. So with time in mind, we'll go on to So Salty, who says, "I don't like this dude. He probably drives an ice cream truck. Can we bring back the brown anime boy?" I don't own a ice cream truck, and the brown boy doesn't like anime. That's all we have to say on that. So we'll move forward to John No Name Gibbon. He says, "Well, no, the U.S. sabotages all movements that have tried communism. So the it's never worked argument is a bit silly. Also, Richard Wolff's democratic capitalism is the best option as it addresses all the awful and very real problems with corporate capitalism, externalities, climate change, foreign intervention, bad trade deals like TPP. Go NASBOL. Fuck these corporatists." Does he have a point? Does the U.S. sabotage all movements that have tried communism? Is that why communism so consistently fails?
Well, certainly not all movements. And we also can't forget that the period of time, the Cold War, when we were seeing the direct competition between communism and capitalism, it was not a one-way affair where the United States intervened in socialist countries, and that was it. The socialist countries, the communist countries, were also competing against the capitalist countries and the liberal democracies. And so, sure, you definitely, he has a point that this wasn't a scientific experiment. It wasn't like we went to a laboratory and checked if socialism works under ideal conditions. However, in the real world with real world conditions, it didn't work out as well as planned. And not all of that dysfunction was due to outside influences. And if we analyze these countries historically, it's pretty clear that that's the case. And you can look at all of the shortages and bread lines and the abuse of power by people at the top in the Soviet Union, for example, as a prime illustration of socialism failing on its promises internally.
And as to the very awful and real problems with corporate capitalism, do you think that has any bearing on our analysis here?
It certainly has its problems, and I don't think anybody really advocates that we should have, you know, disproportionate influence on the government by powerful corporations. Now, to say that we need to throw out an entire economic ideal purely because there are some problems is throwing out the baby with the bathwater, I think. We should definitely consider more gradual and incremental reforms that address the specific problems. I'm in favor of combating externalities with externality taxes and lessening foreign intervention and addressing climate change, just not in a radical way.
And fundamentally, this seems to me that pointing to the flaws of the current system is not an argument for communism or an alternate system. But that being said, we'll move on to Zach Shaw, who writes, despite being someone that is more left-leaning, I enjoy watching your videos. This was a well-constructed, cohesive argument, and I always feel it necessary to challenge what I view. With that said, I would argue that using poverty headcount ratio and stating that large corporations are responsible for that reduction without positing other possibilities is a little disingenuous. So is that disingenuous?
Well, it's definitely partially rhetorical, the way that we went about saying that, but it's also directly combating the position of the Democratic Socialists of America, which was that these corporations, international corporations specifically, were causing all kinds of problems around the world. And one way that I think is perfectly reasonable to address this argument is by pointing out that the same period of time that they're writing that transnational corporations are causing all these problems around the world, about a billion people are being lifted out of poverty. So if you have a issue with that, then really I think the problem is with you. This is a miracle that's happening. And, you know, what's the solution to, maybe the solution is to bringing 2 billion people out of poverty, but it's not ending the mechanisms that we currently have, which are causing these people to rise out faster than they ever have before in history.
Yeah. And with minimal collapse or setback in that regard. I mean, I don't know of a comparable system that has ever managed to produce outcomes even remotely, you know, similar. But he also goes on to say, he sort of says dismissively that they've provided jobs across the world, but that doesn't address the income inequality gap, of course, that, you know,
right,
Ocasio-Cortez and Herkin are hoping to reduce. What is the central focus on, why the central focus on the inequality gap, and why is more important
to some than
right. the absolute reduction of poverty?
He's definitely right. We didn't talk about inequality in our video, and partially that's because we're just constrained by the amount of things that we can address in a short period of time. But the grain of truth in his argument is that for countries like the United States and some other developed countries, wealth inequality and income inequality has been increasing over the past few decades. But in terms of the greater trend globally, the result of pulling these over a billion people out of poverty over the past 20, 30 years is that global inequality in general has declined. So we are at least in this respect making the globe a more equal place through the process of more free trade globally and more transnational corporations. They're not necessarily all good, but many of them have been pretty good. Generally speaking, there's a good economist. His name is Ben Powell, and he looks at a lot of these firms in other countries, and what he finds is that they often offer wages that are well above domestic average wages. So essentially working for these corporations is actually causing for people in those countries to become the rich people in those countries.
And it seems to me that they would have accumulative returns just on account of the fact that opportunity is now there, which was not there, and then that's going to, you know, kind of snowball, you know.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
And it brings, of course, more business in, obviously. So yeah. Anyway, he just says that he liked the video overall, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, it's a very thoughtful comment.
And so thank you for that. Let's move forward to, is that his name? Debates and Discussions? Very befitting. In your Fountain of Blood clip, you forgot Hitler. I mean, he only killed 12 million people, so I guess he's a failed socialist. He wasn't as good as the other heads in that clip. Now, clearly there is some sort of distinction between Hitler and, you know, non-national socialists. For as to why he wouldn't be included among the people that we're directly addressing, because there seems to be a different strain of pathology that informs national socialism versus other forms of socialism. And what could you identify that for us?
Yeah, well, I think that one of the biggest things is obviously the nationalism, and that's the prefix to his party, right? They're the National Socialists. Mm-hmm. I do get that there's a big distinction to be made, again, between Nazis and fascists and socialists, and I accept that. But it's also true that if you read Hitler's writings, and if you read the fascist writings at the time, you read Mussolini, a lot of them were railing just as hard against liberal democracy, capitalist democracy, as they were against the socialists and the Marxists of the period.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because they had the same fundamental disagreements with capitalism as the Marxists. Now, I don't think that makes Hitler a left-wing socialist. It does mean that he rejects capitalism for many of the same reasons as the left-wing socialists.
Right, that's what binds them, essentially. But the distinction is, of course, obviously the elephant in the room is racialism as well, which is not as attendant
yes.
on their strain of collectivism so much as their lines being drawn more on the basis of class, obviously. So that's important to bear in mind, which is why he's not included, because we're specifically talking about class-driven anxieties and movements. So hopefully that clears that up. Marching forward, goose-stepping forward, onto KT Cool, who writes, "Holy shit, dude, did you read her platform? She is a social democrat who believes in market economies. You only did strawman her with DSA, which has nothing to do with her platform. She has explained in many interviews she has given, 1 billion human beings saved from abject poverty. Guess who's responsible for most of that? China, an undemocratic socialist government, which used market economic principles to build their own economic system, which you conveniently forgot or dishonestly omitted."
Well, just starting at the beginning, she calls herself a democratic socialist. I'm not pinning her with a label that she doesn't use for herself. And the other thing is that she is an avowed member of the Democratic Socialists of America. So she does believe in what they have to say. Otherwise, if she doesn't know what they have to say, she's a bit irresponsible joining that group and advertising their membership and arguably causing the massive increase in members that they've gained over the past even just a few months. But as for the billion humans saved from poverty, yeah, a lot of those are Chinese, but at the same time, the reason that a lot of those people are Chinese is because China underwent massive liberalization of their economy. Now, they're still, for sure, they're a less free market than a lot of the countries surrounding them and a lot of other countries in the Western world, but they're far more free than they were under Mao. And that has done wonders for them. But the other thing is India is also responsible for a huge chunk of that. And same story with India. They liberalized the markets there, and they've seen hundreds of millions of people rising above that poverty line over the past few decades. And then there's also a lot of people in South America and even Africa that are also included in that number.
Yeah, I forget the figures with regard to Africa, but it's certainly not monopolized by the Chinese.
It's a very populous populous continent. There's actually a lot of people there, and there's a lot of countries that are growing very fast.
Yeah, I mean, what strikes me as well is if you have a country that has been beholden to socialist government planning and restriction of the economy, of course, when you liberalize it in any capacity, it's going to see a massive uptick in prosperity. But it's not attributable to what this commenter seems to be doing, is attributing their success to some sort of innate superiority of the Chinese system, for which I see no evidence, so much as a testament to the introduction of liberalism to their economy.
Yeah, what we can say is that the Chinese system is better now than it was under Mao. And what it was under Mao was much more socialist than it was now. So yeah, I think anybody can draw an inference from that, which is very simple, that the strict socialism they had wasn't working.
Mm-hmm. All right, and on to Peter Gade, which is a little more technical. He starts with problematic quotes used around the 540 mark. Denmark is a mixed economy that is built on a free market that is highly taxed. Welfare expenses have not gone down and remain an all-time high. Moreover, Scandinavians, Denmark specifically, are not more indebted than Americans. At last, note that the Danish PM is an economical liberal and has a bias in saying that it's not a socialist state, which it is not. He's biased, but it's not socialist, so I guess
that's also true.
Okay. However, we have massive wealth distribution and are one of the most economical equal countries in the world. The social democrats have a massive contribution to how the Danish welfare state was formed, and is highly built on the social democratic thought of equal possibilities of living and rights through regulating the free market. And so what distinguishes a mixed economy from the free market we're speaking of? And indeed, did we ever even maybe rebut the ideal of a mixed economy we are identifying a problem, almost like an identity crisis within the DSA?
No, I think certainly our video is not talking about mixed economies, and Peter Gade is absolutely right. Denmark is a mixed economy, and so is the United States. Now, obviously, the economies and the political systems of Denmark and the United States are very different. But one thing that he should keep in mind is that even these economic freedom indexes, which come out of organizations like the Fraser Institute and the Heritage Institute, they almost always rank Denmark and Sweden and these countries as being more, on average, economically free than the United States. Now, they tend to be less free, according to these indexes, on grounds like taxes and social spending, because Denmark, Sweden, they have higher tax rates, and they also have more involved welfare states. But when it comes to regulations and laws regarding businesses and laws regarding property, oftentimes Denmark and Sweden have a lot fewer restrictions that they place on businesses than do the United States. So it's kind of a wash when you compare the two. They have different strategies to approaching capitalism, but they're certainly not democratic socialist models. And he's right that, you know, the Danish PM, he is to the right of the spectrum. But yeah, as we addressed, Peter agrees with us that
Denmark's, that doesn't preclude being state. Correct. Sometimes you can be on the right of the spectrum and be also right.
Yeah. Another interesting thing to note is income inequality is low in Denmark, but wealth inequality is rather high in comparison to other developed countries. So it's actually higher than the United States. And just to explain the difference between that, income inequality obviously is the amount of money people make. The differences between, you know, the amount of money rich people make and poor people make, for example, every year. Whereas wealth inequality is the amount of wealth they've actually accrued. I guess there's a lot more hoarders in Denmark and Sweden. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. And I've also seen a lot of statistics that seem to suggest that this is accepted. The average income in the United States as a whole, and indeed most states, outranks pretty significantly that of most Scandinavian countries. And of course, income isn't the only measurement of human welfare. But it can't be denied that Americans earn more than your average Scandinavian by, you know, roughly $20,000 or so.
Yeah, exactly. These are mixed economies. And what I would say about that is the United States and Denmark have different approaches to capitalism, which have different trade-offs. So in the United States, you take home more income, you're taxed less, and you get to do more with it, but you have less social services. In Denmark, you're going to take home a lower income and get taxed more, but you're going to have more social services, and you have to kind of compare those things independently, which it's probably outside of the scope of this video.
Yeah, and intuitively this sounds to me like with the trade-off the United States is making such that you have more choice with regard to how you spend your dollars, which itself opens the door for more irresponsible spending, which can indeed often lead to, a lot of people not making wise financial decisions. And maybe, you know, the trade-off that some Scandinavian countries are making such that the government can take a more paternal role and assure you of certain essentials rather than giving you the choice of securing them yourself. Moving forward to Fennec, he says that that is worth explaining that there are two terms, social democrat and democratic socialist. Democratic socialism believes in supposedly democratic control over governance coupled with market socialism, which is collective ownership of the means of production, which attempts to use decentralized planned markets to allocate resources. So, I mean, this sentence seems like a contradiction to me. Without reading the rest of it, the crux of it is such that there is an unclear distinction between, and a lot of people, you know, seem to echo this, between social democrat, which is a more muted, seemingly variant of democratic socialist. But the line is never clearly drawn between what is. It seems to me that social democrat is simply a more palatable variation of it. But they both hinge on the social element of collective bargaining and will. And so what are your thoughts on that distinction?
Yeah, it's an interesting distinction. And Fennec goes on to say that the Nordic model is social democracy and the U.S. model is a mixed economy type social democracy with arguably less free markets than where the Nordic models are successful. So he's making a similar point to some of our previous commenters. One big distinction that I would make, of course, is that we can't address, you know, every issue because the scope of a video can only be so broad before you no longer have a point to it. But I would point out that democratic socialism and the ideas that the DSA advances are often things like, yeah, collectivizing ownership. And that doesn't necessarily mean central planning. Sometimes it means that they want workers' cooperatives where the workers are going to have some kind of democratic decision-making process for how they manage their companies. And what I would say to just address those concerns really quickly and why I dismiss those as well is that management, administration, and the execution of a business are types of jobs that you can specialize in and become good at and become competent in, just like any other type of job. And you want a smaller group of specialized people who know what they're doing to manage those jobs than a large group of people who have very little experience voting on what the company should do next.
Very good. And so next we have Wibblegorn, who pretty much goes to the heart of the distinction between free markets, if you will, and command economies, centrally planned command economies. And he writes that he rejects the idea of profits being smoke signals that show which industries do the most good. Industries like fashion, for example, do not do good on a net analysis. They are hugely wasteful and use psychological manipulation to make people buy things they don't need and which contain little to no marginal utility for them. And this is a very popular sort of line of thinking. I mean, you see like Bernie Sanders tell us that, you know, we shouldn't have so many choices of deodorants or sneakers. And so there's, it seems to this person that prices often reflect an excess of human want. I mean, you have like Supreme, right? Maybe he's thinking of that kind of consumerism where you slap, yeah, Supreme on a brick and it goes for $500. Is that a reflection of capitalism?
I would say it is a problem contained in capitalism, but I would say it's a larger problem with human nature. And the way that I think we should approach political problems and economic problems is not necessarily looking for the perfect system, but looking for a system which is going to incentivize people to do the right things most of the time. And you're never going to incentivize people to do the right things all of the time for obvious reasons, right? Because people are imperfect, and sometimes there's very evil people, and sometimes there are people who will psychologically manipulate people. But what I would say is that the market system and the liberal democratic system so far has been the best system at aligning the incentives of the very wealthy, the CEOs and the boards of directors, as well as the very influential, the politicians, with the needs of the general people. And that probably sounds insane to a lot of people, because there's a lot of things that the United States has not done right, and there's a lot of things that a lot of Western liberal democracies have not done right. For example, I think the drug war is just a fantastic example of where democracy failed for almost 100 years, prohibiting substances like marijuana, which we now know has been very harmful in terms of all the mass incarceration in the United States that has occurred due to this prohibition and the rise in organized crime surrounding the marijuana industry. Clearly, democracies and even capitalism gets things wrong sometimes, and people are manipulated. But there is far more, there's a far larger propensity for that manipulation to become very, very dangerous in a centralized socialist system where either you're dealing with massive central planning by a few of the economy, or you're dealing with these democracies in the workplace, which would be just as susceptible to demagogy as any other democracy. Yet now you're also having to deal with the incompetence of people who are never trained to be managers and never trained to be CEOs and never had the competence to perform those jobs in the first place, suddenly being promoted to that level of responsibility.
Yep. And I would also say that his total rejection of smoke signals, of profits as being, you know, indicators of where resources are best flowed, is not accurate. You know, I mean, of course, consumerism is a problem and it exists, but that doesn't change the fact that profits as a signal are unrivaled simply because of the fact that it removes the power from any one hand, which would be infinitely incompetently suited to the task of determining where they should go. It does that organically. It does that without any sort of need of conscious intervention on the part of any one actor, you know, which makes it sustainable across a system of 310 million individual actors.
Even larger with the world market.
Exactly.
But yeah, to address a specific point there, I think that I don't think that you can point to a specific market, even if he was correct about the fashion market, that it was purely based on manipulation, which I agree with you. It's probably not. The fashion market is probably not just based on psychological manipulation. But even if I were to agree with him that maybe one part of the economy was subject to this kind of manipulation, that doesn't mean that the whole system is rotten to its core. And we need to be really careful not to abandon a system which usually gets the right answer and switch to a system which usually gets the wrong answer because of one mistake.
Yeah. And that goes to the heart of it, which is basically that, you know, if you're a fish in a fishbowl, after a while, you probably just take for granted that you're ensconced in water. And perhaps you begin to long for something else that is to your ultimate detriment. But All right, well, I guess that about wraps it up. It's been pretty spirited. I think that by now we've exhausted your mental resources. So we'll leave the rest for everyone else to consider. Very, very good, thorough analysis on your part, Jason.
Thank you. Okay. As same goes for you.
Well, I try my best. All right. That does it.